You're listening to your community radio station. It's KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K224 CQ Anahola, K284 AL Haleiwa. It's time for In the Garden on the Farm.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. I'm your host, Paul Massey, Director of Regeneration's Botanical Garden, and on today's show, we'll take a permaculture perspective on our relationship with the Aina. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is brought to you by listeners like you in partnership with our generous underwriters.
Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe in Hanalei is proud to support KKCR and its Ohana, offering organic groceries and produce, a cafe featuring fresh salad bar, hot meals and soups, fresh-made smoothies, and baked goods. Located in the heart of Hanalei, Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, 826-0089.
Anahola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building Island Koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored design and special orders. Prompt and complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. AnaholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645.
The Kauai store is located in Kapa'a on the highway in front of Kostulas. The store has authentic Kauai products including clothing, snacks, art, coffee, crafts, and more. We even have local food samples. The Kauai store products are also available online at thekauaistore.com.
Garden Island Hydro, assisting with all your aqua hydro soil growing needs. Nutrients, mediums, all natural compost tea, lights, aquaponic and hydroponic components, and more in their 1,700 square foot warehouse at Puhi Industrial Park, Lahui. Family owned and operated. Open Monday through Saturday, 246-4769, 246-GROW.
Thank you so much, Kauai. Thank you for our sponsors, our underwriters, I should say. And thanks to Dean, who's up on a chair painting the ceiling right now, renovating this beautiful studio here at our Jungle Shack, here up in the jungly North Shore of Kauai. And I'm joined today by Tammy Davis. Great to have you back, Tammy.
Thank you.
So glad you're here to talk gardening, because we really like to garden. And the act of gardening is one thing, but when it's time to stop and talk about it, it's really good to have a friend who shares the passion to spiral up the energy in the discussion.
Yeah, thanks. Good to be here.
Yay. So we want to let you know we've got the spring membership drive coming up really soon. It begins on the 12th, running through the 25th of May, and the show for In the Garden on the Farm is going to be on Wednesday, May 18th, and we're going to be counting on people who appreciate the show to call in and make your pledge to support this show, to support the station. So many people giving their time and energy to making this place happen. My little job every Wednesday is hauling the trash to the transfer station, and I'm really grateful that there's just some way I can plug in. And it's so complemented by so much of the effort. I mean, I come in and there are so many things that are just I don't have to think about because somebody else has taken care. And that's everything from taking care of the physical facility here to scheduling to fundraising to managing so many aspects. And we're just grateful to be on air with you today. And thanks for your support. So if you want to jump in, you can become part of the early bird team by going to kkcr.org and enter yourself for a two-night stay in the Hanalei Bay Resort, and also an opportunity to become a wave rider again. Have your announcement aired over 100 times during the course of the fund drive for a nominal fee. It can be a business mention. It can be just a message you want to get out to the community as well. So consider that. And we are going to enjoy some discussions today on permaculture, ways of looking at the land, and some workshop and gathering opportunities to get together with other plant nuts like ourselves. But we're going to start with our celestial session, our look to the skies and the traditions of biodynamic as well as the traditional Hawaiian planting system based on the Hawaiian moon. And today's Hawaiian moon phase, courtesy of the 2016 Hanalei Moon and Tide Calendar from the Hanalei Watershed Hui and many other collaborators, including Waipa Foundation and the feds and lots of good people. So today's Hawaiian moon is Lono. And so it's the Captain Cook moon, I suppose, as he was mistakenly thought to be Lono as he arrived at the Big Island. And Lono rose over Kauai at 4:33 a.m. this morning. She reached her transit, her highest point in the sky, at 10:52 a.m., and she will set at 5:15 p.m. Later on this afternoon. Only 5% of the moon's beautiful face is illuminated. We're just finishing up our Hawaiian moon month. New moon coming up on Friday at around 9:30 in the morning. Lono is a good time for planting ipu, gourds, and melons, which are both kinolau, or the physical embodiment of Lono. Other Lono plants, kukui and uala, sweet potato. And then for our biodynamic look at things, brought to us by Heaven on Earth starts right here on Kauai. We're still in the ascending moon phase, and Robin has sent us some recommendations. Today the moon is in the constellation of Pisces. Time to work with our leafy plants. And then Thursday, it's going to be an unproductive day based on certain planetary influences. So we'll skip Thursday in terms of planting. And then Friday, the moon enters Aries, a fire sign, which is a time to work with our fruiting plants, prune or harvest fruits. And then Saturday, the moon in Taurus, an earth sign, time to work with our root plants, weed, and harvest root crops, is Robin's recommendation. Sunday, the moon stays in Taurus, but again, some other celestial influences will make Sunday an unproductive root day, an unproductive day to work with our rooting plants. But then on Monday and Tuesday, the moon enters Gemini, an air sign, making it time to work with our flowering plants, and we will be entering the descending moon at that time next Monday and Tuesday, which will mean good time for transplanting flowers. I was so hoping to get some cuttings made. We had some good biodynamic influences over the weekend, but I got too busy, so I didn't make it. Unfortunately.
Oh, did you get too busy for plant cutting?
Well, I'm not sure. we had a beautiful weekend, and a dearly departed uncle passed away on the west side, James Gonsalves, and beautiful family gathering for him and the whole community coming out. And I did cut some sugar cane, which was enjoyed. So it's funny, too, with the sugar cane, just reminded me of, it's funny how with direct experience of things as a planter, some things that you could learn your first time out, it took me 17 years here on Kauai to learn. And with the sugar cane, I had just really never, planted a whole lot of sugar cane. And it was only this year around that I'm discovering firsthand how significant the rat damage can be when the rats get into your sugarcane patch.
Are you planting like 1 foot sticks, like 1 foot segments?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so basically it's time to harvest the canes,
yeah,
and I'm behind on my harvest, mm-hmm, and the rats have located it.
They'll
beat
you to it,
huh? Chewing the living daylights out of that sugar.
They're going to have really good shiny teeth, those rats.
Indeed.
Because that's what I think I've heard, that the sugar cane is really actually good for your teeth when you eat it raw.
Yeah.
And you take the little pieces and use it to pick out whatever else is in your teeth.
Truly. So it's just interesting, you know, that's something that a beginner could learn, but it took me a really long time to learn it.
You're busy doing more complex things.
Well, no, just working with other plants, really.
Yeah.
There's so much to learn about every plant and all the tricks and that kind of thing. But I would say that after beginning to plant sugarcane, it's so rewarding. I mean, it's really easy. It's another one of those plants that's just so easy to grow. And what a wonderful, from so many aspects, being able to eat it. We haven't pressed the juice, but I'm going to be skipping over to One Song Farm and asking if I could use their sugarcane press.
Oh, good thing they have one in the community.
That we have. And then, of course, being able to perpetuate the traditional Hawaiian varieties.
And they're beautiful. Like some of the colors and the stripes and purples and greens and yellows, they're really gorgeous, just even as a decorative, you know, clump, and then you always have some in your on your land.
Truly. And we do have plenty to share, so I would say that if people are interested, come on out to the Kauai Food Forest in Kalihiwai on a Saturday, and if you come soon, we always have cuttings available for volunteers, but right now we have an abundance of sugarcane, and I would be very happy. You'd be doing us a service, too, if you planted, of course, because then you'd be backing up the collection wherever you might be growing. And I'm just very happy to get some of those canes out to the community.
That's one thing I really love about the food forest, is that it is kind of like a cuttings bank. You have the seed bank where you have to keep it more protected, refrigerated, and but it has to be planted and regrown every once in a while or the seeds will go. And so the live cuttings, like, we have so much potential to deck out so many people with everything they would need to start a whole another food forest. And That's really important. That's a resource, a community resource that was created by the community. And with a lot of work on certain people's parts, it's still being, you know, tended and made available. So anyone who actually, you know, comes to the island or lives here and has been afraid to start something, they can come learn how to tend it by volunteering at the food forest. And as you learn and work with a plant, like maybe walking around chopping and dropping some nitrogen fixers or learning how to protect, you know, the trees that we are getting fruit from, how to prune them. We did a workshop where we learned how to prune them. And then I had all kinds of better ideas of how to take care of the ones that I have. And I think it's just such a great learning opportunity and an investment in the future to propagate all these things.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. I agree. And it's kind of turned the corner in terms of the management where I feel more like it's a good example of what to do as opposed to a cautionary tale of what to do, which it was in that state for a little while.
Sure.
But we did have the workshop at the Earth Day, and thank you for attending some of that. And we do have a lot of different kinds of nitrogen-fixing plants, and we're putting in more. I finally discovered a plant I've had in the nursery that was just a question mark for me of what species of leguminous tree this was, and it turned out to be the anterior lobe. Ear pod or elephant ear or those are the two common names I suppose that are used for it. And it said from what I've read in terms of information on that particular species, it seems to be somewhat on the par in terms of size of albizia, however not as tall. And certainly if it's being used as a chop and drop plant, you don't ever have to let it get as big as an albizia, and certainly we won't be letting it get anywhere near that close. But it is said that it is it responds well to coppicing.
Would that remind you of a monkey pod? Like, I heard ear pod, I heard nitrogen fixer. What would be the, can you compare that a little bit?
Well, monkey pod, from what I've read, is actually can suffer greatly and actually be killed from very aggressive coppicing or cutting off of the limbs for green.
So you couldn't manage material. It in the way that we do the coppiced things.
Yeah, so we can't use it like our chop and drop, other right. nitrogen fixing chop and drop.
They're
plants.
Like a good overstory for a large area where you can have the shade that's created by the monkey pod and all the leaf drop that happens, that could really benefit something right. that could grow underneath it. But you wouldn't right. manage it the way we're managing to keep it small and just pumping out greens and keep chopping them and turning them into soil.
Right. So we have a few of these ear pod trees in the nursery, and we're going to be planning out more NFTs, or nitrogen fixing trees, in the coming weeks here to provide some measure of weed control during the summer growing period. And it'll be fun to see how it stacks up against our other nitrogen fixing trees in terms of the organic matter production that it can do.
Yeah.
So that'll be fun to add that to the mix. And then also during the Earth Day Rising event, following my workshop, Tammy taught a workshop, and it was really very cool. I got to experience some of the workshop, and you were showing off the operation of a very aesthetically pleasing device, and tell people about it. Tell me more.
Yeah, we had a copper alembic, or distiller, from Portugal. And I have a pretty big size one, so I can do, I don't know, you can put about, I don't know, a gallon and a half of plant material in the column. And then you can boil the water, and usually we go for about an hour. And then it's a particular design where you can dump the material and restart without having to dump all the water, so you don't lose all that invested fuel and heat.
Oh, cool.
In your water, so it's actually unique in that way. But it's bigger than most distillers are smaller in glass and beaker sized, and this one's bigger. And it turns out copper is also a really great material to use. Even when they started switching to stainless steel and glass, they realized that the distillate didn't have the same qualities. So some of the master alchemists said, well, there's something important about the copper, so they started actually putting like a steel scrubby of, well, copper, like, you know, you use for cleaning pots, in the steam's path. So the copper would end up interacting with it anyways, even if you have a glass or a copper distiller. And they say that sweetens the distillate. So there is some, you know, ionic interaction, and it's important to the quality of the product. And it seems like it makes a better distillate. So what you end up with on the other end is some hydrosol and some oil. And very, very, very little essential oil comes out of a very, very big pile of plants. So just learning that and illustrating that, we saw that the rosemary was what we used.
Right.
And we got volunteer, you know, our people donating rosemary from all over. I trimmed lots of different people's landscaping and gardens to get the rosemary. And we had like a 6x8 tarp full of rosemary branches. And we probably got about a couple gallons of hydrosol, and then only like maybe even less than half an ounce of oil, maybe even like a quarter ounce. And part of that is because we're in a humid environment, and a lot of these plants are, they produce oil in a dry climate. They're like Mediterranean plants, and so.
Like rosemary.
Yeah, so they would produce more oil if they were more stressed, actually. So if we grow stuff on the west side or in Maloa in certain areas, and you're trying to grow things for their essential oils, just remember that. Dry is better.
Interesting.
Lavender, anything like that. But, you know, we had a really good time, and we learned a lot, and people got to take home some hydrosols. And a hydrosol is the oil is infused into the water. So you get a spray. You can spray it in the air. You can put it in a diffuser. But it has a really strong aroma, and it releases the essential oil as you spray it into the air. And it's amazing smelling. It's fresh. It tasted, you know, it's like you can almost taste it. It's really.
And how do you think it would work as a preventative for insects? You know.
Yeah, I would think some of the more citronella-y things like that would be for that. Rosemary is really good for your skin, for your hair. It clarifies the mind. It has like a brightening effect. And it's also good for your, it's an antimicrobial, antibacterial, so anything for your digestive and, your respiratory system, where you would be taking it in. I've been putting it in a diffuser in my house, and it's really nice.
Ooh.
Yeah, and then people make lotions and soaps and all these different products out of hydrosols. So yeah, we had a really good time, and we hope to, we collected a list of people who want to start collecting plant material. Actually, what I'm looking for now is gardenia. We want to do a gardenia, and so it takes a lot of flowers.
It's kind of the right time of year for that, or what do you
I know somebody has, they called, I put an ad on Heartbeat for the rosemary, and they called and offered, and they said, but I have this gardenia bushes that are going off right now. So Maloa'a has some gardenia bushes that are flowering, and if anyone else has any, you can give me a call. We could collect them and get enough to do another session. and we would end up with a really yummy smelling gardenia hydrosol.
Yeah. Would you like to give out your phone number for people who would like to do that?
Sure. Yeah, if you have access to a lot of gardenia flowers and you want to experiment with us, you can call me at 541-510-9658.
Super cool. Tammy Davis, skilled at many, many things in relation to plants, and it was so fun to see this beautiful distillation device from Portugal. It looked to me like an antique, but you said it was only a few years old.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so great that in other parts of the world, people are still making things like they used to, you know, dispelling that concept of they don't make it like they used to. But sometimes when people hit on a good design, they don't have to improve it. And although it looks antique, it also sounds like they have been improving the efficiency of the design of this thing.
The cool thing is that you can use this on an open campfire. You could use it on a propane burner or a stovetop. So it's accessible regardless of your source of fire. And I thought that was really important to make sure we always have tools that can work under various conditions.
Yeah.
And, you know, as long as you have a little bit of cold water or running water, some people use, like, stream beds to run their cold water through a still. But, you know, luckily we have a hose that had pressure.
Uh-huh.
And that's really, you know, a fire and some water. And this alchemy really works.
Very cool. And in addition to hosting distillation parties, you've also been prepping and readying to host some tea gatherings. And you had a small tea gathering just a couple of nights ago. I sure wish I had been there. But I'm understanding I'm going to get another chance coming up.
Yeah.
What's that all about?
I really love just geeking out on plants, and that's why I like hanging out with you. And so I thought, well, it would be really fun to combine the tea parties that I've had in the past where we sit around and drink tea and discuss a certain topic and have like a specific focus and take one plant at a time and really just learn as much as we can and draw the knowledge out of the community of what they know about that plant and what are the different uses. And so I'm hosting these tea salons where we will focus on one plant at a time. And this one we did, we're going to do again on the blue butterfly tea. It's a pea plant, so it's also called blue butterfly pea. And it has a lot of magical properties. And it's also something that can grow here, and we found out some people are growing it. And so I think it's got so much potential, and it's really fun to play with. So it's a bright, bright blue tea. And then it's very sensitive to pH changes. So when you add lemon to it, something magical happens.
I've seen this plant growing at Wonsong Farm.
Okay.
And other places on Kauai, and it's fun when they're now certainly maybe Wonsong wouldn't be an example of this because Sun certainly knows multitudinous uses of plants.
Yeah.
But the blue butterfly pea is one that sometimes people grow purely for its ornamental value, and people don't know that they're growing a medicinal, useful plant in their that they have a pharmacopoeia out there.
It's true.
And so it's great to reveal these inner dimensions of the plants.
It also has like a strong cultural use in Thailand, and there's a lot of things that you see that come from Thailand that are bright blue, food as well as tea and beverages. And so a lot of people said, oh, I tried this in Thailand, but I thought it was artificially colored. And it turns out that this plant is so strong and well-known in Thailand. Almost all the YouTube videos about it are in Thai. So they've been using it, and they know how to make things really bright blue using a natural, actually healthy plant. And then we look at the constituents inside the plant. What are the chemical things that we can identify? What are their effects on the body? You know, what's the creation story about this plant within any culture that it comes from? Where was it distributed on the planet? What's its journey? And so we want to look at potentially in the future more plants. And so nutmeg was on the list, and vanilla, and tea, the Camellia sinensis plant itself.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe chiave is something I'm particularly really interested in. And we'll just see how I mean, I could do this for years.
We're not going to run out of plants, that's
no.
for sure. So in accompanying this is the consumption of tea that may or may not include the plant of focus.
Right. The tea just kind of helps focus the discussion and provides a ritual that we can all, you know, sit down together. And it sort of provides like a mental, like a resting place for a nice focused discussion. So I really enjoy that environment. And I've always been serving pu'er tea in the past, but now I'm looking at, well, whether we have the pu'er tea is from China, what do we have growing here that we can use as our tea? And there's a lot of things we can make tea from on the island. And we also are looking at mushrooms as well as plants. So there's the turkey tail is on the list, which is a medicinal mushroom that does grow on the island. And we probably will do a foray for that one. We'll go walking around and identify it out in the field and then have a little tea party.
Great. I can imagine some potential collaborations with some of the commercial tea operations on the island that are sprouting up here and there, joining you in that as well. But it's so fun to find out what we can make tea with, and that is so unlimited, really, yeah. In terms of pretty much anything we grow in our garden, we could make a tea from if it's edible,
mm-hmm.
And then some things that aren't even edible, like I guess turkey tail isn't super edible, yeah,
but it's really woody.
Really woody. So, as well, the discussion portion, we talked about, you know, how great it is if everybody can add to the lend to the discussion. So, if people know what the plant focus is, they can either come sort of with a blank slate and get filled up, or if you want to do some research, you could actually add to the volume of knowledge. And with something like the blue butterfly pea, it's not like you picked ulu, where like so many people know so many things about it or have direct experience with the ulu now. There's a lot that could be revealed through sort of doing a little bit of homework before you get there and maybe bringing some if you have it or, so it's a great idea. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. So we'll announce when the date and the place comes up. It's not been quite, I'm pretty sure I'll be doing that in the month of May.
Mm-hmm.
And there's several different locations I'm looking at and it's going to be fun. Whoever we collaborate with, and there might even be several of them, but at first, you know, we're going to try this, see how it goes, and then see who likes to play in that way and keep going.
Well, I have an angle on my research for it, but I'm not going to tell you. So that it's fun because it invites a creativity. It's like, well, I don't want to research the obvious stuff. So how can I sort of get to the outer fringes of what would be relevant?
Great.
So that'll be good. And not only that, but Tammy, I'm really excited that we're able to announce the return to the mushroom cultivation workshop coming up on May 22nd. This is the return to the material, although an expansion somewhat of the experience that we had earlier this year.
If you missed it the first time, now's your chance. I had a lot of people ask me afterwards, oh, I missed it. What day was it?
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to offer again because I want as many people as possible to know how to keep these mushrooms running and happy here on the island because there's so much potential benefits for all of us.
Yes. And so you put together a great slideshow. Then there's hands-on experience in terms of cultivating a couple of different types, and exciting that we'll be expanding the inoculation that we did last time around of the King Stropharia mushroom, whose mycelium has expanded greatly in the wood chips that we pasteurized last time around, and we'll be doing that pasteurization process again.
Yeah, it's great. The Albizia chips just keep coming off the highway, so let's keep inoculating them. And we had success. We weren't sure if the Stropharia would take, so that workshop was an attempt to inoculate and see. And it turns out they are just so happy in there. Mm-hmm. The mycelium is thick and ropey. You can see it. You stick your hand in there. It's all connected. It's like a very successful colonization.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll build on that at the next workshop. Plus, we'll review the things that we learned at the first workshop. Really, anyone who's already taken it might want to come again and reabsorb, or they might just, you know, somebody who missed it would come And but I'd love to keep collaborating and hear back from anyone. I have run into a few people who started the oyster mushroom mycelium, and some have it still going and haven't transferred it and don't know, remember the next step. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of learning involved in growing mushrooms. So it's good to check back in and just tell me how it went, what went wrong, what went right.
Yes, please. Please be in touch if you were one of the many people who attended the first time around. We'd love to know success stories or challenges that you had so that we can improve. But just like choosing plants that are suitable to your particular location, mushrooms have particularities of the environment, of the media that they're growing on. And when you chance upon a success like we have with the King's Trefaria, it's exciting and just makes me want to try something else and see, you know, okay, what else is going to be successful? Yeah. Of course, getting the mycelium to run is only part of the story. And so maybe we could focus a little bit more, too, on our next strategy of how we would induce fruiting with that variety as well.
And luckily, somebody who attended the workshop last time had already grown some Strepharia onto ironwood chips, and he had his first fruiting body that he was so proud to show off. And I was so glad he came because I didn't know him before, and now we have, you know, a connection with people who are already trying things. And so he got to show us the fruiting body and the chips and everything that he had already done. So, you know, and again, last time we had to turn people away, so I'm hoping, you know, all those people that were interested and didn't get to come, that you'll come join us on May 22nd.
Yes. Thank you. So Sunday, May 22nd, Mushroom Cultivation Workshop, starring Tammy Davis, our in-studio guest for In the Garden on the Farm, here on Kauai Community Radio, KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea. It's 12:30. We're here until 1 o'clock. And I want to give a shout-out to the good people of Po'oku Community Garden, Gray and his team. They're over at Kauai Fresh Farms today, helping to clean out one of the greenhouses. Kauai Fresh Farms, Marquita and her team donate to the food pantry every Wednesday. Happens on this very day. And thank you so much for your generosity and just a great reciprocal situation there. You know, the concept of gleaning, which Gray is a super strong advocate and practitioner of. There is always, you know, at the end of the harvest, there are leftovers that may not be completely marketable, but are absolutely quality food that shouldn't be going to waste. And, of course, if you're making it back into compost, nothing is truly wasted. But if, as we look at the highest and best use of food, and we have hungry people here on Kauai, that food is highest and best used by getting to them. And so thanks to everyone involved. And I'd like to play this little PSA here for Church of the Pacific. And we'll hear Gray in his own words.
Church of the Pacific, providing Wednesday's free food pantry. A community garden. Facilities available for events, music, craft fairs, meetings, classes, volunteer opportunities. Church of the Pacific, where community gathers. The little church with the big heart. 826-6481. ChurchOfThePacific.org.
Thank you, Gray. And so many food pantries, there are dozens of them around the island. So to everyone who participates in getting the food out to the communities wherever you are, spoken or unspoken, your names, you are deeply appreciated. And getting a couple of calls into the studio. We don't have, we've got a dialogue here going between the two of us, and we don't, it's a bit difficult to take a pause for discussions with us here. But feel free to, if you have a comment, you certainly could email it to me at inthegardenonthefarm@gmail.com. If you have a question or a comment, send that off to us, and I'll get to those comments by the end of the show today. inthegardenonthefarm@gmail.com. Thanks so much for calling in. We'd love to hear from you and have you be part of the gardening discussion here as well. And right now, we're going to turn our attention to permaculture. And it reached my attention that International Permaculture Day was actually on Sunday the 1st of May. So kind of missed noting that, but just that idea that permaculture is being practiced all around this planet, and it gives us an opportunity to look at things with a new eye. It's really, you know, maybe the oldest way of looking, the intelligent observation of the landscape. And it's a great thing to do whether you're starting out fresh or maybe you've been doing a garden or a land project for years. It's good to go back to the basics. But Tammy and I both take some time helping people. We do consultations from time to time with people who have land projects. And a lot of times people are looking for this kind of service, don't have experience with some of the concepts of permaculture observation. And so we thought we would take the time today to explore some of those observations that can be made. And so even if you don't have us come out, you could think about some of these areas of observation and research for land.
Yeah, I think that's a really important concept, is to pay attention and observe for as long as you possibly can before you make any decisions. And a lot of landowners will just jump in there and already have this sketch in their mind, and they don't actually even know where this, you know, water flows across their land, for instance. That's a really big one. And a lot of things, mistakes can be avoided if you just stop, slow down, and hang out on your land at all different times of day, camp out there, spend the night in your yard, see what happens, like, throughout the day, and where do the animals go? You know, so there's so many things that can be learned. And of course, indigenous people have known this all along, and we've sort of been recapturing some of that indigenous knowledge and combining it in ways that Western people can understand. And that's what I think of as permaculture, is like re-indigenizing people who've maybe lost touch with their ancestral lands and learning how to see that way again. And hopefully gleaning as much possibly, you know, knowledge from what's left. And I think that's really important, that when permaculture was taught on Molokai, Jeff Lawton was here, and he's from Australia, and his major word of encouragement was that there were Hawaiian people in the room, and he said, you know, we're teaching your ancestral way of living around the world right now. So your people were one of the handful, like less than 10 cultures that knew how to do a sustainable landscape, because you had these limitations of the ocean all around. So they had to be sustainable to make it here, and they really had it dialed. And so we can still learn so much from what they did. And so I think that's really important anywhere you live, is to look at how it was done before.
Right. And that goes all the way back to the beginning of habitations here on Kauai, but it also is maybe more easily accessed by our neighbors, people who live in the area. A subset of those people have been making those multi-generational observations of the land and carry that tradition, that awareness, that knowledge forward. And oftentimes those people are very quiet about their knowledge. Maybe they never even thought that anybody would be interested. Maybe they are understandably, appreciably protective of that knowledge. And sometimes you know, it's not out of a wanting not to share, but just not wanting to share out of turn, where it won't be received in a good way, where it won't be received by a receptive heart and a receptive mind. So one of the first things that I encourage people I speak with, and really myself too, is to continue to establish those relationships with people who are in the area. Find out who's been around and who's been through, who was here before the hurricane, who was here for the, you know, the big floods, and what did they observe? What do they have growing in their landscape? What don't they have growing in their landscape? There's so much that there's so much of a story that can be told by people in the area. And of course, developing those relationships isn't just about getting information from them, but it's that creating that strong network of community that really is a hallmark of indigenous cultures, is the strength of the community as a whole. And I'm grateful to continue to be shown example of how important it is to prioritize our relationships with each other. And we're very fortunate here on Kauai that there are multi-generational families and traditions here, and that with going with an open heart and a humble request, almost without exception, I've been met with people who are willing to share and wanting to share some of these deep observations that they've made for a long time. So bring a notebook and listen closely, and maybe bring some fruit to share, or find out how you can help your neighbors, because they will become your greatest allies through time. And I think that that's, you know, personal observation is so important, but you can learn decades or centuries of knowledge by speaking with people.
Yeah, and I think one of the design elements is, it is, how does it connect to the watershed? How does your land connect to the rest of the community? How is what you're going to do affect upstream and downstream? Mauka te makai, like thinking like a watershed, thinking like a ahapua'a, the way that it's been done with a... with the Hawaiian culture that I understand, is that somebody's keeping an eye on the whole big picture and advising each of the little segments that people are working with, so that it's managed for the good of the whole and for the good of the whole community. So, you know, I mean, when I think somebody wants to do a permaculture landscape, you want to put it into a cultural context. You want to look at the big picture. You know, you want to look at how is what you're doing beneficial to the whole community, and what are you providing for your neighbors, and how is what you're doing going to affect them? And even if you're in a tiny little lot versus, you know, a big acreage, you might think about, you know, shade and water and how things, you know, affect other things. And but I think water is one of the most important ways that I first look at land. And, you know, where, how, what's the rainfall? What's the history of the rainfall? Is it changing? And where will it flow in a flood event? What's going to happen in a flood event? What's going to happen in a big storm when you put on these little flimsy, you know, stick fences or rock walls that maybe aren't that secure? Where is the water going to go, and what's it going to take out on its path? Mm-hmm. So you kind of look at that the whole time. And, you know, another thing is, how do you make best use of the water when it is just normally flowing through? How do you slow it down, spread it out, you know, pool it somewhere where it could be useful? We always look at putting water up high in a permaculture design. Like, how do you store water where it has the greatest potential? If you put a tank or a pond and you put it at the top of your land, then you can just have a gravity flow system to get it to where normally maybe it wouldn't flow, but you can put it irrigation to it. And without any extra energy or power, you can just open the gate and there's your water going to that dry hillside or something. So those are, I think that's one of the first things I look at. What do you like to look at when you get onto a piece of land?
Well, certainly, yes, if there are telltale signs of water and wind, that those are great voices to listen to. And yes, water is both really our greatest, one of our greatest resources, but also one of the most destructive forces that can play out on the land. And certainly capturing of water needs to be planned extremely carefully, because there can be, you know, ruptures of ponds and, you know, blowouts, washouts, all these kind of things. So there are some firmly established techniques, and really needs to be looked at closely, I think, before implementation occurs. I like to look at the plants myself. Of course, if people have been there, you can tell something about, you know, if ultimately in your system you want to have productive plants and there are already productive, at least species, whether or not they are being productive at the moment, they can tell you a lot about the soil fertility. They can tell you different things about the quality of the soil they're growing in, not only the fertility but the drainage. But I like to look at the wild plants too, or rather to say the naturalized indigenous and endemic plants, whether, you know, plants that weren't planted by humans I think it's really interesting to see what is persisting and which ones of those we might choose to keep or might have to live with, and other ones that we would absolutely want to remove as soon as possible. And recently visiting a friend's place and doing a permaculture assessment, we discovered just a little bit of cat's claw on the land. And luckily, really early establishment, like maybe just one plant, there were seeds present, was kind of interesting because it was growing on a halicoa tree, which, and they're both legumes, and so maybe with a just a short glance, you might think that it was just halicoa, but with a little bit more of a look, you realize, oh, there's two different kinds of seed pods on here, and one of them is the cat's claw.
And tell us why you wouldn't want that.
Well, cat's claw, unfortunately, is not, people often make the mistake that it's una de gato, which is a medicinal cat's claw that a tea, actually that would be an interesting plant to focus in on your tea salon sometime. And I wonder actually if the cat's claw that we have was unintentionally introduced, mistakenly introduced by somebody who thought they were introducing the medicinal one. But the cat's claw that we have, which is a Cesalpinia species, making it related to one of our rarest native forest trees, the uhi-uhi, but also the Cesalpinia bonduc, which is an indigenous plant that also has thorns, similar to the cat's claw, that, however, the cat's claw has horrific thorns on it that tend to grab and hold your skin when you so much as brush against it.
I bet the pig hunters could tell you good things about about that. If they're
that it captures their prey.
Yeah, it probably just rips the rips everything to shreds that tries to pass through it.
Whew.
So you don't want a copse of cat's claw unless you really, you know, like you just really don't ever want anyone to ever go through there ever again.
Right. But
which
yeah.
is one way that nature does protect certain areas, I've noticed.
Yes.
Like, I think certain plants develop these really, you know, intense defenses, but sometimes it is for the healing, long-term healing.
Right.
But when we're in the environment, we also want to look at, you know, what are the human needs, what are the animal, plant, soil needs, and we were sort of looking at that discussion earlier, what's an invasive versus what we use in permaculture called pioneer plants,
right.
And what is the natural succession versus the speeded-up human-assisted succession. So what plants can we use and utilize and their kind of aggressiveness, and then we take them out when, as long as we can.
Right.
If we can manage them, we can use them and harness that energy and then replace them with something more useful.
Yes, and a good example of that in the location I was speaking of is elephant grass, which is a otherwise known as Napier grass. And this is a large-scale grass on the order, actually even taller than guinea grass, what people often refer to as buffalo grass, but is guinea grass. And highly productive organic matter creator, but it also eventually, once it gets past 1 year in size, in age, it develops the ability to be vegetatively propagated as well as is a copious seeder. So definitely invasive, but I heard recently from an elder that a planter on the Big Island is growing unbelievable sized kalo by managing the Napier or elephant grass by mowing, letting it go, and then mowing it and planting the taro. So that would be an example of a plant that you wouldn't want to intentionally introduce, but maybe you don't necessarily want to get rid of it either. This particular location where I was doing the assessment was formerly Lo'ikalo, which is the flooded taro field, and perhaps it was introduced as a forage, or perhaps it was introduced actually to improve the soil for taro production. And so we can learn to work with these plants, similar to working with albizia.
Right, and with animal management, you'd also look at what eats it and what comes out the other end, and is it viable or not? So if it's something that can transform these nutrients into fertilizer, mm-hmm. and just looking at running through, you know, these animals running through carefully managed, you can improve your soil by having them eat up an invasive plant and, you know, leave behind some fertilizer. You just have to look at, you know, how do we harness this energy? Because it's nature. It's nature speaking to us, and we have to learn to read those patterns and make best use of what's available. And another permaculture principle that I think we want to point out that this is indicating is the problem is the solution. And sometimes we look at, you know, a situation and we're like, oh, this plant is a big problem. But it's the solution to something else if you look deep enough. So it could be that, you know, you're using it to refertilize the land. So like the kalo, like you're using it for fertilizer. Instead of buying fertilizer, maybe you can just use the problem.
Right. Indeed.
So hopefully we can find more creative ways to respond to what we see, perceive in the world as problems. And just keep looking at things that way. It's an important principle, I think, to apply to our life as well as the landscape.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. So other things with a permaculture assessment, we want to look at the aspect of sun exposure. Fortunate if we have full sun exposure, which can be mediated by shade, but sometimes we're really challenged by a north-facing slope or something like that, and wanting to make good choices about placement of different elements in the system. Permaculture going back to that idea where we're trying to create perfect harmony between the needs of the environment and the needs of humans to work together. And so really a key aspect, too, is finding out what people's goals or intentions are for the project. And so it's really nice when they have a close alignment with the ability of the land to supply that. But sometimes, you know, people have a dream of something that is a bit of a challenge to accomplish. And so that's perhaps when we need to return to listening to what the earth has to give us rather than trying to ask the earth to give us something that it can't. Mm. There's always something, and certainly in Hawaii, no matter where you are, there's something magnificent that can be gleaned from our relationship with any piece of land here. But sometimes we need to sort of step back and say, okay, maybe I can get half my list accomplished.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, working with nature, what grows well here, what's going to do well without so many inputs? Because we create unnecessary work for ourselves. And in the permaculture I learned, unnecessary work is the definition of pollution. Either a product that can't be utilized because we don't know how to use it best, and or creating unnecessary work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that mulching is really like a great way, you know, to look at managing things that, you know. Well, I want to say, in addition to that, when somebody has this desire for permaculture, landscape, or consultation, one thing to really get clear with people is that it's not a static landscape you're going to implement and then you just walk away. All these ideas and systems are meant for human interaction. It's meant for your participation to be included in the long-term plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important. People have to be willing to go out and interact with the landscape and be a part of it and notice things and harvest at the right time. And, you know, the timing is really important in a lot of these systems. We can set it up for the succession, but if you don't go in, harvest, chop and drop, pull things out and start over, you kind of miss the boat. It gets out of hand, you know.
And it's not about thinking that you know exactly what you want at any given point in time, but it's about that process of the discovery of, mm-hmm. oh, I thought I wanted this, but then I discovered that this was actually my favorite part of the land because of something I observed, or I decided that this interaction with the landscape is the part that is the most rewarding for me, mm-hmm. and so I want to now put more energy in that direction. So there's always, when we make our recommendations, we're always focusing on do small experiments first. It's really worth the time. I know it seems like you just want to get started large scale oftentimes. I'm happy to say that the people I consulted with most recently totally get it, that don't be in a rush.
Yeah.
You know, do something on a small scale, see what works, keep looking at other people's examples, and decide what kind of lifestyle you want, because the land will take everything you have to give and more, I know this through and through myself. And, you know, it's very easy to overextend, especially when we open the land too much, and then we have that fear that we've caused damage. And, you know, it's very important for us to do small scale experimentation during that process.
Start small. Start right outside your door, and then just make small changes for the greatest effect. These are all principles that, you know, it's easy to see them in the book, but when you start living it, you start seeing how important it is to remember them. Mm-hmm. You know, because like you said, if you open up too much land and you're not ready to actually initiate and manage it, then you just create another opportunity for these so-called pioneer/invasives to have their way with the open patch you created. So really be only, and looking at like some of these things are just holding the soil until you can get to it. Even if it looks like a crazy overgrown section,
right.
It's better to let it do its thing until you're really ready to step in and start interacting.
Truly, yes. Learn the plants, know the value that they give by holding the soil in, providing organic matter. Don't cut the howbush until you know that you want it gone, because what a valuable plant that is, and so many more. So I hope we have inspired you to take another look at the land around you. And sometimes, too, I can say that, you know, it's easier for me to see somebody else's place and make recommendations than it is for me to make to sort of see what I need to do on the land under my care. And so it's really nice to have a reciprocal arrangement, or, you know, reach out to others and ask for help, even if you're somebody who thinks you ought to know enough at this point, because I definitely need support from my friends on good development. And again, going back to the food forest, we're really getting to a point now where we're going to be making some of the rounding up some of the decisions about where the major plants are going to be located. We have a lot planted already, and now it's kind of like, oh, we have a finite amount of space left to go, and we want to be making really good choices moving forward. So finish that to say, come make observations with us and help us out at the Food Forest each and every Saturday from 8:30 to noon, 2:30 to 5. You can find out more information by going to kauaifoodforest.org. And as well, want to remind people that we have the mushroom cultivation workshop coming up with our friend Tammy here on Sunday, May the 22nd. And you can go, we don't actually have it listed yet, but you'll be able to register online at ribg.org coming up really soon. We'll set that up for you. And Tammy, thank you for sharing the discussion with us today.
All right. Thank you.
And please stay tuned for Kauai Vibrations with Tracy coming up at 1 o'clock, 1 to 3. And Shaka Kayaka already in studio putting together his show, The Pupule Show, from 3 to 5. And much more coming up after that. I want to share this one PSA with you before we go, and then I'll say goodbye. But we do have the Canoe Surfing Challenge coming up. Let's hear about it.
Coming this May, the Poipu Beach Canoe Surfing Club presents its 8th annual Canoe Surfing Challenge at Kalapaki Beach on the beautiful island of Kauai. Big fun, baby, and really small prizes. Divisions: 4-man surfing canoe, foam board, beach boy, and brand new, never before seen, double hull 4-man canoe surfing. Wow, what is that? To enter or for more information, canoesurfingchallengekauai.com or 808-652-8897. May 8th at Kalapaki Beach, surf permitting.
All right, sounds good to me. And thank you, Sonia, for your email. And so, yes, a reminder that we want Tammy's telephone number for more information about the tea salon as well as the upcoming mushroom cultivation workshop. You're on, Tammy.
All right, my number is 541-510-9658.
All right. We're going to be doing some night gardening in the food forest coming up soon. I'll let you know about that, but I was out there last night in, under the beautiful evening skies, and sure was a good time. And I look forward to spending some of that time with you, too. Stay tuned for Quiet Vibrations. And until next time, we love you, and get ready for the spring membership drive starting on May the 12th. And tune in again next week. We'll be back to talk gardening with you. Aloha, everyone.